Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight on redboxmedia.com. Join me now to reflect upon the magnificent history of our beloved Catholic Church. I'm so glad we could get together again. This is Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin.
And we're coming to you on that wonderful webcasting network, redboxmedia.com.
The Catholic Church is so magnificent.
So much of it is hidden from the contemporary mind.
People know so little about the great achievements of the Catholic Church on earth. The most magnificent human entity of all is the Catholic Church, in every area, intellectually, artistically, and of course, in faith, hope, and charity. In the many aspects of music, one of the most universal and oldest is bells. Bells are very old. An important part of Setting the Record Straight is not just correcting misinformation, but uncovering the true magnificent information. And for the next few moments, we're going to think about the bells, the church bells. More bells. The show right before this was called Bells. It was about bells, and I just had to do more. This is one of the church bells ringing at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Dover, Ohio. It's a beautiful sound. Those are wonderful bells. Let's let them all ring from St. Joseph's Church. As we finished the last program, I was playing that beautiful passage from the opera Tosca by Puccini. When all the bells of Rome ring one after another because it's dawn, and a man who's about to be executed is writing a last letter to the woman he loves, Tosca. He's in a cell in the castle of the Holy Angels, the Castel San Angelo, right on the banks of the Tiber. And they bring him up on the roof, where he's about to stand before the firing squad. And they give him time to write this letter. And meditate. He begins writing the letter by candlelight, but then the sun rises. Even today, there's a wonderful view from that point. You can see all Rome spread out before you, the Vatican at your right, the Tiber below you. He's in a building that was Hadrian's tomb, is now called Castel San Angelo. When Giacomo Puccini wrote this music, he adapted the music to the exact pitch of the great bell of St. Peter's Basilica. He wanted the music to be exactly right, with bells, Rome awakening to the sounds of church bells. He didn't live in Rome. He traveled down there and went up on the top of the Castel San Angelo to measure the sounds of the morning bells there as they would be heard from its ramparts. He had exactly the right bells for this scene, cast at four different families, but he wasn't satisfied. Illica, the man that wrote the words, the librettist for his opera Tosca, wrote about this. He said, "The great fuss and large amount of money for the bells have constituted an additional folly because it passes completely unnoticed." and forever after, because this opera is very famous, done a lot. All around the world, it's a lot of trouble and expense to get the bells to do this opera. I'm recording this at dawn myself, and I'm sitting before a big window. My studio's at the top of my barn, and I see beyond the goldfinches fluttering around my feeding station, and I can see for miles over the rolling hills of the June Kentucky landscape. Rome is a beautiful creation of man. The sun is rising now, and this God-created landscape of Kentucky is glorious too. And somehow I felt that it would be good to hear that again. The Catholic Church has such a magnificent history in the arts and in this one area of music. There's a glorious history of bells in the Catholic Church. Our bells are sacramentals. Our Catholic bells are one more species of prayer, one more kind of prayer. For a more joyous sound from close to the same spot, let's go to Christmas Day 2010. This point of hearing is in St. Peter's Square, immediately in front of the Basilica. And this is what it sounds like from St. Peter's Square, not far from the Castel San Angelo. Here's the bells of St. Peter's in a more glorious mode. Christmas Day 2010. Of course, bells precede the Catholic Church by many thousands of years, probably. When gong material and rattle design were united, the first metal bells came into existence. Though bells like this are very common among primitive people all over the world, usually made of gold, silver, copper, tin, every other kind of metal that can be worked into sort of a nut shape. The nut shape you're familiar with from the jingling kind of sleigh bells. And then once we had blacksmith, because that's who makes the bells among primitive peoples, among pre-literate societies. Some of the Indians in Peru dance in the street to the music of a pipe and tabor, with the times marked by the ringing of small bells tied to the legs. The old Morris dancers of Britain had this custom too. Bells have even been found in Egyptian mummy cases. They're usually of bronze, and some of them resemble the bells of the Assyrians. You even find them in the Egyptian necklaces. The early Hebrews had bells. In Exodus, the directions are given for the robe of the ephod. Quote, a golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate, upon the skirts of the robe round about. In Exodus 39:25, the robe has been finished. Quote, and they made bells of pure gold and put the bells between the pomegranates upon the skirts of the robe round about. Between the pomegranates, a bell and a pomegranate, a bell and a pomegranate, upon the skirts of the robe round about, to minister in as Jehovah commanded Moses. The tinkling sound of these golden bells upon his robe announced the coming of the high priest for the sacred ministrations. You come to Zechariah 4:20. In that day shall there be upon the bells of the horses holy unto Jehovah, which implies a custom of having bells on the horses, maybe fastened on the bridle or forehead of the horse. The historian Josephus said, ancient civilizations often thought that bells signified thunder, or they looked upon them as signals of victory and dominion. The golden roof of Solomon's temple, Josephus says, had bells fixed on it to keep birds from alighting. Euripides said that Greek war horses had small bells on them. Hopefully they would terrify the foe and spur the warriors into action. Even the Greek shields had bells in their interior. In Rome, Augustus had a bell hung before the Temple of Jupiter. A bell ringer walked before funeral processions. And they were hung on triumphal cars and summoned guests to feasts. And, of course, the Greeks and Romans hung bells on the necks of horses, dogs, sheep. In Rome, the bathing hour was announced by a bell, as were the other times of the day. Of course, they had no clocks yet, because the monks who invented the first clock with an escapement mechanism hadn't done so yet. In the garrison, the Roman sentry wore a set of bells on his breastplate so that the centurion might know from the sound that the sentry was being faithful to his duty to patrol. There was a custom that a watchman made the rounds of the camp ringing a bell, and the sentries replied to him by shouting, or in some other way. Among the Etruscan antiquities, an instrument was discovered which was constructed of a number of bronze vessels placed in a row on a metal rod. They were bells. Very ancient bells have been found in Ireland. The earliest seemed to be of Roman origin. There's three types of bells found in Ireland, and they were probably used in ancient war dances or maybe by the Roman pagan priests. As you might expect, the Turks forbade the ringing of bells. They said the sound would disturb the repose of souls, which they thought wandered around in the air. And they regarded a bell as a symbol of unfaithfulness, the opposite of what they were in Rome. Wherever the Muslims conquered Christians, the conquered Christians substituted metal or wooden plates for the bells, and they struck them with a hammer. But in spite of their objection to using bells, Muslims looked forward to hearing bells in paradise, shaking golden-shafted trees of Eden. Well, we're sliding into a break now. How would you like, on the way out, to hear the ringing of the largest church bell in the world at the Cologne Cathedral in Germany? It's this kind of thing that makes Catholicism so much fun. We'll get back together on the other side.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
What you're hearing is Change Ringing. This is setting the record straight and bringing forth the magnificent accomplishments of the Catholic Church, one of which is church bells. And the incredibly sophisticated art and intellectual art of ringing church bells, of bell ringing. Now, Change Ringing is the art of ringing a set of tuned bells in a series of mathematical patterns called changes. There's no attempt to produce a conventional melody. You've been listening to a beautiful peal of bells, which is the way you say a set of bells, a peal of bells. Some towers that do change ringing have as many as 16 bells, which can be rung together. Six or eight bells are more common. For convenience, the bells are referred to by numbers. And, of course, the bells are mounted within a bell frame of steel or wood. Below the bell chamber, there may be one or more sound chambers, one of which is likely to house the clock mechanism, and through which the rope will pass before it drops into the ringing chamber. Typically, the rope's length will be such that it falls close to or onto the floor of the ringing chamber. About 5 feet from the floor, the rope will have a woolen grip called the sally. When the bells are not ringing, they're normally left hanging in the down position. But prior to being rung, the bells will be rung up. In the down position, the bells are safe if a person touches them or pulls a rope. A bell in the up position, with the mouth of the bell tilted upward, or even not in the level down position, is pretty dangerous to be near. It could swing and knock you down the tower. And only expert ringers should ever contemplate entering a bell chamber or touch a rope when the bell is up. The ringer pulls on the rope and starts the bell swinging. Each time the bell swings, the ringer adds a little more energy to the system, similar to pushing a child's swing. Bell ringing, done properly, is a highly sophisticated art. I'll give you an example of some of the patterns that go into change ringing. Let's listen to a synthesized version of what they're doing. There's many patterns. We're going to listen to Tittums because of the tittum sound it makes. We're going to listen to Queens. This one is called Rounds. And this last example is called Backgrounds. Backgrounds. We could go on, but this will be enough to give you the idea. Will you hear the magnificent result of what happens when you employ these techniques? Now, first you're going to hear a descending scale repeated. Around. Then there's a change to something much more complex. Listen to this. All I could say is, wow. If you've reached the adult stage of life, then you know that nothing is easy as it looks, nor is it simple as you thought it was before you knew something about it. Would you like to hear a few more little stories from the history of the Catholic Church and bells? How about these? In around the year 400, it was in the city of Campania in Italy. The Bishop of Nola, we're talking about Paulinus, who I referred to in the other program, he conceived the idea of having one large bell fastened on top of the meeting house so that all the people might hear it, instead of having a bell ringer go around in the streets. So Paulinus evidently suspended a large brass kettle above the roof of the church, and someone struck it with a hammer to notify people when prayers were supposed to begin. The records aren't very detailed. Pope Savianus was the first to use church bells. Year was 604. He had them rung at different hours of the day so that people could keep up with the times which had been set to pray. So here we have the early liturgy of the hours. But modern Italians honor St. Paulinus on July 25th as the first man to institute the use of church bells. Bells were carried by the missionaries into the British Isles, and those good saints, Patrick and Cuthbert, always announced their coming by sounding bells, just as the town criers did many centuries later. So bells came with Christianity into Great Britain. Of course, Christianity meant Catholicism in Great Britain at that time. There were no Protestants. So the bells were brought by Catholic missionaries into Britain and have been very closely identified with Catholic church services ever since, more than any other musical instrument. It is thought that a man named Turkettul, he was an abbot of Croyland, hung the first peal of bells in what was to become England sometime in the 8th century. So gifts of bells to churches and monasteries became a very common habit around this time. The Saxon King Egbert gave orders that all priests should ring the bells of their churches at the appointed hours in the 9th century. And they rang upon the death of a bishop. A little later, Alfred the Great ordered the church bell to ring every evening at 8 o'clock as a reminder it was time for everyone to put out the fire and go to bed. Yes, it was a world lit by fire. This is the bell that was known as the curfew bell. So as time went on, more bell ringing orders were given until the bell began to be one of the most important parts of the church. Before the radio, before the telephone, before electronic communications, the bell was a great medium for communication. And of course, the monasteries had foundries, and that's where they made bells. In the Abbey of St. Gall, a bellmaker named Tancho made a bell which had such a wonderful tone that Charlemagne liked it very much. Tancho said to Charlemagne, "My lord emperor, command a great quantity of copper to be brought to me, and I will purify by fire, and let me have silver instead of tin, about 100 pounds, and I will cast for you such a bell that all the others in comparison with it shall be mute." So Charlemagne did that. He ordered the required amount of copper and silver to be sent to the bellmaker. But he didn't know the character of Tancho. Tancho put all the silver aside for his own use, thinking no one would know the difference, and made the bell of copper and tin. When he finished the bell, Charlemagne ordered it to be hung and the clapper attached. That was soon done, and then the warden of the church, the attendants, and even the boys of the place tried one after another to make the bell sound. but it wouldn't. So at last, Hancho came up. They were all looking at him suspiciously now. So he stepped forward and took the bell rope. He gave it a good pull and got a surprise. Tumbling down from high on the tower came the brazen mass, fell on his head, killed him on the spot, and smashed him flat. After he was dead, they went through his bell foundry. Stored away, they found the 100 pounds of silver. Charlemagne ordered it distributed among his poor servants. A lot of us are Irish Catholics. I plead guilty. And among the most famous ancient bells are those of Ireland. The holy bells of Ireland are not round as found in the rest of Christendom, but have a kind of irregular cylindrical form. Irish bells are most often ornamented with crosses, the fleur-de-lis, and the pomegranate. A number of so-called St. Patrick's bells are still preserved. Many are in the Dublin Museum. They're of various sizes. Even the largest one is a little more than a foot tall. St. Patrick is supposed to have had around 50 bells. The sweetest sounding one is known by the name of Finn Fedeach. Most of his bells were bronze, usually beautifully adorned. One of them is half iron. The clove bell, or black bell of the saint, is an alloy of different metals, about 12 inches high. When he drove the demons into the sea at Croagh Patrick, Mayo, he flung after them his bell. It's not known which of the bells it was. A historian, O'Donovan, wrote about this. He said, according to all the lives of the Irish apostle, he remained for 40 days and 40 nights on this lofty mountain, which was then infested by malignant demons, who opposed his progress in preaching the gospel in this dreary region, but whom he drove thence headlong into the sea. So this was done by means of his bell. Another version of the story says that the bell was brought down for St. Patrick by angels from heaven. And he scared the demons away, not by the mere ringing of the bell, but by mighty blows. In Ireland, they even have shrines for these cherished bells. Shrines for bells like this seem to be unknown in any other branch of the Christian church. The Dublin Museum has bells of St. Columba, which had the same virtue as those of St. Patrick in the expulsion of demons. Some histories tell us that the bells were brought from Rome by St. Patrick, St. Columba, and St. Mungo. It seems that Patrick came from Gaunt, Ireland about the year 440, and he brought with him a group of skilled workmen and a number of bishops. Among the workmen were metalsmiths, bell makers, and braziers. He founded monasteries, placed the bishops to preside over them, and set the smiths to making bells for the monasteries. He designated that, quote, the smiths should make bells, and the braziers should make the patens, and the ministers the altar chalices. These bells weren't cast, as modern church bells are, but were made of thin plates of beaten metal, bent into a four-sided shape, riveted along the sides with a handle at the top. The best ones were dipped in a solution of molten bronze, which filled up all the openings and coated the bell, making it more resonant. And they seemed to be rung by being struck with a hammer or a small mallet. A clapper was evidently added later on. The early Christian missionaries held these bells in such veneration they were looked upon as sacred, as sacramentals, and preserved with the greatest care, along with the Bibles and walking staves of the saints. A characteristic of the Irish is that they've always greatly revered their sacred relics and preserved them so carefully that many of these bells have been handed down for over 1,000 years. We'll be right back with more of Setting the Record Straight. I'm Chuck Coughlin, and this is BreadboxMedia.com. We'll be back in a minute.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight, back after the break. I'm Chuck Coughlin, and this is BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight about the glorious history of the Catholic Church. We were reflecting on and listening to bells. The history of the clock is intimately bound up with the history of the bells. Where there was a time when the sun and the moon were the only guides which man had for the measurements of the divisions of the day and the night. The sundial was invented to make more exact use of the sun's light for this purpose, and later burning candles, burning rope, and in the hourglass grains of sand were used to measure definite units of time. They even used water. They had a couple of vessels which allowed water to drip slowly from one to another. It's called a clepsydra. The amount of water which dripped from sunrise to sunset was taken as a guide, and this was divided into equal parts for the divisions of the day. The clepsydra was used by ancient Egyptians, Greeks, Chinese, and Romans. Now, in the early days of the Catholic Church, the day was divided into 8 equal parts, or canonical hours. And the bells were rung in the monasteries on these hours to call the monks to prayer. The large church bells were also made to serve this purpose, so that the entire community might be notified of the canonical hours. So that's how we eventually got to the Angelus, isn't it? So this is perhaps the earliest use of the bell as a time marker in Catholic countries. And these bells were rung by hand, either with or without ropes. Clocks driven by weight were invented in Verona in the 9th century, and this was also invented by the monks to announce the canonical hours. So it was only natural that these inventive minds would turn to connecting the weight-driven machinery with a metallic ring to announce the hours, and striking clocks were developed. But the measurement of time became much more exact with the next invention of the inventive monks, the escapement mechanism, where a metal arm rocks back and forth, advancing a little wheel with gears on it. The Catholic Church and its clergy has always been a major force in leading the world in contemplations of time and eternity, and even taught that the world had a beginning, as indicated in Father Georges Lemaître's now-accepted Big Bang Theory, which I prefer to call the Big B, inspired by Genesis. Father Lemaître turned the eyes of an amazed and humbled scientific community back to regard the instant of creation, of the appearance of something out of nothing, out of a void. On a smaller time scale, the Catholic Church taught the world to use Pope Gregory's calendar. Today, every nation has adopted it. During the French Revolution, they developed a new national calendar and tried to get away from it. But the calendar is an excellent one, and it is the standard, and they went back to it, symbolic of the rest of the Catholic Church. They'll come back. On an even smaller time scale, hours are measured by clocks. As far as we know, monks invented the first mechanical escapement clocks. These clocks did not have a face displaying time, but instead told a monastery bell to call the monks in from their labors to gather and to recite the liturgy of the hours. Some historians believe that this was an invention of the definite workday. It was no longer sunrise to sunset, but the measuring of an 8-hour workday in payment by the hour became possible. While we're on the subject of the monasteries and metalworking and metallurgy, bell foundries, because of the matter of the blast furnaces, the oldest known blast furnaces in the West were built around 1100 in Switzerland, Germany, and Sweden, where a furnace was active from 1150 to 1350 A.D. Many technological advances were transmitted within Europe by Cistercian monks. This included the blast furnaces. The Cistercians are known to have been skilled metallurgists. The Protestant Reformation in England suppressed and often demolished the ancient monasteries. As a side effect, this impoverished the formerly prosperous common people who had centered their lives around these gracious and sturdy institutions. The technology of the monastery's blast furnaces was lost, and as a result, delayed the Industrial Revolution for 2 centuries. The monasteries diffused their advanced industrial technology into outer society. Historian Jean Guibfault wrote in his book, The Medieval Machine, that, quote, every monastery had a model factory, often as large as the church, and only several feet away. A water power drove the machinery of the various industries located on its floor. Iron ore deposits were often donated to the monks, along with forges to extract the iron, and within time surpluses were being offered for sale. The best of this metal was used in making bells. They had bell foundries. In medieval days, when the new bell was finished, the date for its baptism was set. Some important person in the community was chosen as the godfather or godmother of the bell. No kidding. And usually a white christening robe was made for it, as for an infant. The form of the ceremony which took place is a little like this. The new bell was brought into the church and hung at a height convenient for the priest to reach. On a table nearby were placed the sacred vessels containing oil, salt, and incense. Also water, napkins. Linen cloths are placed underneath the bell to receive the water used in washing it. The church dignitaries in their formal robes stand near the bell, and the choir is ready. First, psalms are sung. The officiating priest, or perhaps bishop, blesses the water and salt, and the bell is washed and wiped with a napkin. This bathing with salt water is to make the bell demon-proof. More psalms are recited, then the priest dips his right thumb into the vessel of sacred oil and makes the sign of the cross on the bell with his thumb, at the same time saying a prayer. This oil is wiped off and the choir sings the 28th psalm. During the psalm, the priest says some Latin words, Sum te fecetur et consecretur Domine, signum istud in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. In other words, he consecrates the bell in the name of the Father, and Son, and Holy Spirit, calling the name of the bell and of the saint to whom it's dedicated. While reciting these Latin words, the priest anoints the bell 11 times with more oil. Then, after prayer invoking blessings on the bell, it is solemnly incensed. Incense is burned under it, filling up the interior of the bell. And the choir sings Psalm 76. Then there's another prayer, more chanting, and the priest in grave silence makes the sign of the cross on the bell, covers it with a white garment, and the ceremony is over. So that's the baptism of the bells. Nothing in those days exceeded the pomp and solemnity of a bell christening service. Great sums of money were expended even in poor villages, and feasts were given. In the accounts of the church wardens of St. Lawrence, dated 1499, we have this quote, Paid for hallowing of the bell, named Harry, and over that Sir William Symes, Richard Cleish, and Mistress Smith, being godfathers and godmothers, at the consecration of the same bell, and bearing all other costs as a suffragan. Now, of course, indulgences were sometimes granted at the consecration of a bell. For instance, 1490, Bishop of Ely granted 40 days indulgence to all who would say 5 paternosters and 5 aves at the sound of the great bell, and 5 aves at the sound of the small one. Here's one of the prayers from the medieval ceremony. Grant that wheresoever this bell thus washed, baptized, and blessed shall sound, all deceits of Satan, all dangers of whirlwind, thunder, and lightning, and tempests may be driven away, and the fiery darts of the devil made to fly backwards at the sound thereof. In Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's Golden Legend, we have an account of storm fiends being commanded by their master to destroy the Strasbourg Cathedral bells. They fail, and the storm fiends attribute their failure to the fact that the bells have been baptized. Here's a verse. All thy thunders here are harmless, for these bells have been anointed, and baptized with holy water, they defy our utmost power. Consecrated bells were also supposed to have the power, merely by the ringing, to put out fire as well as to cancel storms and protect the community from lightning and pestilence. A lot of bells in the Middle Ages bore this Latin inscription, I break the lightning, Franco Fugura. Many sacristans were bidden to ring the hallowed bell in the great tempests and lightnings. In many places, the ringers hurried to the church belfry as soon as threatening clouds appeared, so that the storm might be broken up before it became severe. During the 1800s, a traveler in the Alps wrote this, "Bell ringings as the companion of thunderstorms is a permanent institution here. The man in charge of the chapel is on the lookout for thunderstorms and begins the bell ringing and continues to ring until the storm passes." Well, out here in the country in Kentucky, it's the siren that warns of the possibility or reality of tornadoes. And you hear that quite frequently in the summer. So the non-electronic means of communicating with people has an advantage, is that everybody has an opportunity to hear it. You don't have to have your device turned on, your radio, your TV. It's recorded that as late as 1852, the Bishop of Malta gave orders for the church bells to be rung for an hour to allay a gale of wind. In some parts of France, they still do this. The important part which the church bell played in the lives of the people in past times is perhaps best shown by the number of ways in which the church bells were used. One writer says, "To call the fold to church in time we chime. When joy and mirth are on the wing we ring. When we lament the departed soul we toll." We'll be back in a minute. We're going to take a break here on Setting the Record Straight on BreadboxMedia.com. You're on the website, BreadboxMedia.com. You see that square that says Bless the Yes? Well, Yes is an acronym meaning You Ensure Support. 50% of gross revenue from our advertising agreements referred by you will stay with your organization of choice. Click on Bless the Yes.
Breadbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. Back after the break. I'm Chuck Coughlin, and this is breadboxmedia.com. You know, one of the major goals and purposes of Setting the Record Straight is to reveal the glorious beauties of the Catholic Church, and that's included the sound of its church bells, of its sacred bells. Setting the Record Straight seeks to restore the glories of the Catholic Church, too often ignored or forgotten, or just passed over. We were talking about church bells, and of course they ring for different parts of the service, and reminded the people of the different days of the church year and the anniversaries that had to be remembered. Announced the hours of the day and told of important things that happened in the community. Some rich parishes took pride in having separate bells, distinct in tone for the different uses. These classes of bells even had different names. They were usually Latin names. The campana was the big bell that hung in the steeple and called the people to church. It's called Campana from the name of the city in Italy where the bishop lived who first used a big church bell. The squilla was a small bell in the choir, rung at various parts of the service as a guide to the singers, and also to announce the different parts of the service to the congregation. The Gabriel bell was the big tower bell, and it served a lot of purposes. And sometimes it rang so often during the day that it might have been bewildering to somebody that did not follow the meaning of all the signals. But all the services during the day were announced by the church bell. The sermon bell indicated there'd be a sermon. The pardon bell told just before and after the service, at which time the worshippers prayed for pardon of their sins. And the pudding bell was rung immediately after the service was over. It was supposed to give notice to the cook to prepare the dinner. Probably it was the ancestor of the modern dinner bell. Now the sacring or holy bell, this is the same thing as the Sanctus bell, was rung to call attention to the consecration at the elevation of the host. Everyone kneels. Do you know the name of the clock bell? The one in the tower that tolls the hour of the day. It's the dupla. Now the cymbalium was the bell in the cloister used to give signals to the monks. Nola was another bell named for the Bishop of Nola, who, as we said earlier, was the man who first used church bells.
But when somebody had to receive a punishment, be whipped, a separate bell was rung. It was called the Kirigi Unklum. Now, if a parish could afford two big bells, one of these was the campana, or regular church bells, but the other one was rung at least 8 times a day for various announcements to the people of the parish. It was called the signum, like sign, S-I-N-G-U-M, signum. There was a ringing of bells sometimes when people were dying. If these passing bells were rung while the person was dying, evil spirits were frightened away, and the soul could pass on in peace. Even in ancient Greece, they beat on brazen kettles while a person was dying to scare away the furies. So perhaps that was subsumed into Catholic practice. Who knows? But the practice of tolling church bells after death and during the funeral services is still very common as a way of showing respect to the person who died. That's the death knell. It indicates by a certain number of rings whether it was a man, woman, or child who has died. In old days, the most common signal was 3 rings for a child, 2 times 3 for a woman, and 3 times 3 for a man. Sometimes it was a smaller bell for children. And on Halloween in England, it used to be the custom to ring the bells all through the night. Henry VIII wrote a letter to Archbishop Cranmer, quote, "Against superstitious practices wherein the vigilant ringing of on All Hallows Day at night are directed to be abolished, and the said vigil to have no watching or ringing." But the people were slow to give it up, for he later read that Queen Elizabeth ordered that the superstitious ringing of bells at nights next and before and after be prohibited. Ah, we come to the curfew bell. For hundreds of years, an important time teller. The ringing of this bell dates far back, to the 800s, when Alfred the Great ordered the inhabitants of Oxford to put out their fires every night at 8 o'clock, when the bell at Carfax rang. About 200 years after this, William the Conqueror enforced all over England this same custom, which Alfred had started at Oxford. But they had to put out the fire, and matches hadn't been invented, so it's difficult to start a new fire. So what they did is they covered the red-hot coals with ashes in the evening before going to bed. And these coals would keep alive until morning. And that's where we get the word curfew, because they developed a kind of metal cap to put over the ashes, which kept out most of the air, and the fire was better preserved. This metal cap was the fire cover, which the French word is couvre-feu, which finally began to pronounce curfew. You couldn't go out after curfew rang. In England, there was a law that provided that, quote, no man, woman, or servant should go out after the ringing of the curfew. And that was enforced for centuries, but it gradually died out. There's something called the pancake hell. Yes, the pancake hell. And it's associated with a curfew bell. For on Shrove Tuesday, the curfew bell was the signal which stopped the eating of pancakes. That's Shrove Tuesday is the Tuesday that comes 40 days before Easter Sunday. It was a day for eating pancakes, in the same way the Americans eat turkey and pumpkin pie on Thanksgiving. Shrove Tuesday, the church bell rang out at 4 o'clock in the morning as a signal for the people to prepare for the Feast of Lent. Here's something from some old writings. Quote, as a part of this preparation, they collected all the suet, lard, and drippings in the house and made it into pancakes, for this was the last day they might eat butter for 40 days. And they wished to take full advantage of it. Any pancakes left over were put in the fire. Listen to Poor Robin's Almanac for 1684. Hark, I hear the pancake bell, and fritters make a gallant smell. So the pancake bell was sometimes called the fritter's bell. When we've skipped many, let's talk about Christmas chimes. You can remember these from Charles Dickens. Children everywhere sing about the merry bells heralding the glad tidings of the birth of Christ. Many old churches have bells that have been tuned to the different notes of the scale. That's a carillon, and they play Christmas hymns like O Come All Ye Faithful. And you look at Christmas cards, a lot of them have bells on them. And on December 31st at midnight, for centuries, the old year was declared dead with the tolling of bells, and the new year heralded with joyful ringing. We still have that customs. This is the second of two programs on bells we're doing on setting the record straight on church bells, especially on Catholic church bells. In the first of these two programs about bells, I opened it up with a description of a drive I took out from Lexington to just below Bardstown to Our Lady of Gethsemane Abbey, a Trappist monastery near Bardstown, Kentucky. And I played the sound of the Gethsemane Abbey's church bells from a distance because, as I described, it was a summer's day, a beautiful summer's day, very warm. And so I turned off the car's air conditioning and lowered the windows. I was still 2 miles away from the abbey. And then I began to hear it in the distance. It was near noon, and the bells were starting to ring at the abbey. And we drove closer, and finally we could see it in the distance. And I slowed down because the whole scene was so beautiful in the low Kentucky hills. And I remember that Thomas Merton writing about the fact that he could hear the cannons fire at Fort Knox, which was only a few tens of miles away. I used to live at Fort Knox. I know what he's talking about. Anyway, I read some words of Thomas Merton. They're so beautiful about those very bells. But I've got some words of my own to say about that beautiful afternoon and hearing the bells and coming closer to the abbey and seeing it. Here's my words. Bells of Gethsemane, ascend to the tolling out of your night. Break open your sheath of sleep and arise. Lift your sight to the round ringing word of a sun soaring up to the tintinnabulating helium, in each hour polishing the flash and heft of the valley, to an illumination rendering transparent the haunted frescoes of your dreams. True time tolling, true colors burning, true magnitudes, confirmations, positions, and valences. The authentic body appears beyond the fading scrim of your sorrows. Steeple rings exhortations upon the hour, spelling out the hour's number, pronouncing the resonant name of your soul. Now see godlight shimmer on the sailing leaves, on loaves of mown hay. Out of the silence of his meditation, a monk rocks the bell into huge tolls that roll out into the hills. Laborer, draw aside your shroud of field hand to reveal a God hand. God's arm is hoeing deep in your soil, uncovering the quick root to water and light, releasing sprouts clasped in prayer. A thunderhead of green and gold baptism resounds. Wake up. Your name is called in the distant tolling. It takes your hand. From sleep you are lifted. From labor you are gathered to chant psalms. From your painted grave where you lie, celebrating a chaos of strange voices, you are exhumed. Every hour you are buoyant in a new soul rise. You are dawning light, soaring over the tended fields. Flocked with the rolling voices of the evangelical bells.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.